in the world of Mesoamerican archaeology, as people have learned more and more about the Olmecs and the Mayas. Work like the reports recently given by John Clark at the Library of Congress show that the old criticisms of what people used to think went on in Mesoamerica have proven wrong. But the world that is depicted in the Book of Mormon is being accommodated and supported more and more as those bits and pieces are accumulated. We don't have definitive proof yet, but the composite of all of the factors that are being accumulated support the Book of Mormon and tend to diminish the old criticisms in significant ways. You know, sometimes people have criticized the Book of Mormon saying that it talks about Nephite coins, and coinage wasn't really invented until after Lehi has left Jerusalem.
There have been no coins found in ancient America because they didn't exist, and they don't exist in the Book of Mormon. The header note to Alma 11, which describes Nephite coinage, is almost certainly wrong.
The header is a modern edition and has nothing to do with the text. It certainly isn't unusual that people will read that section of the Book of Mormon and assume that it's coins, but we do that with the Bible too. We will read ourselves back into it and make assumptions about the early culture based on what we believe. And so we read these things and we say, oh, it must have been coins.
But those headings were not on the plates. From our understanding, some of the modern brethren put those headings to try to give us kind of a guide. But in the actual text itself, it mentions different weights.
It describes pieces of metal. It says nothing about them being stamped or minted, which is what makes a piece of metal a coin. There's no reason to expect to find Nephite coins, because I don't think they ever existed, and the Book of Mormon doesn't claim they do.
The actual idea of these differing weights being used as a weight system in the monetary system, it's actually in the Mesopotamian, the Akkadian, and the old Babylonian, come to think of it. This is how they used their money, was through weight.
In fact, even the Israelites used weights initially. The Bible mentions some. The most common was what's called a shekel, which comes from the verb to weigh. It actually is the verb meaning to weigh.
We know that coinage first appeared apparently in Lydia, in what is today modern Turkey or Anatolia. And you see in some burials clearly the transition, which occurs after Lehi's departure by about a century or so from the New World. You see mixed hordes of stamped minted coins and also specific weights of metal that are not shaped, minted, or stamped. So there was an evolution there in a sense. People went from fixed weights of metal to actual coins. Lehi left just before that change took place.
And that's what we have in this weights and measures section of chapter 11. It's part of a big picture of the legal reforms that explains why those weights and measures were initiated at that time, and they conform with what one would have expected from the ancient world.
We always have the problem of trying to impose on the text our own imagination of things. You have to read the text very carefully and try to filter out your own cultural presuppositions. Ancient people didn't necessarily live, think, or act exactly the same way we do.
It was not a big industry, to be sure, but metallurgy never is.
There is mention of fairly low-level metallurgical practice in the Book of Mormon. There's no evidence that it was a huge deal, that they had massive foundries or anything like that. These things may have been very small. Whether we'll find them or not, we don't know. We haven't found them yet. Metal remains one of those interesting problems in the Book of Mormon. But there are suggestive clues that metalworking and metals, knowledge of metals, existed in the Americas very early.
We do know that metals were around, that they knew about them. Going back to the Olmec people, in the Sokan language, you can reconstruct a word for metal. So we know that they had a word for metal. It was important to them. It was sufficiently important that it got passed on.
And those terms are shared, but they've been modified in each of the languages, which points back to an original word for metal. We haven't found it because there are no inscriptions from that period, but those variant words all have to have come from a common source. Otherwise, how to explain that the same word occurs in all the different languages?
But linguistic evidence tells us that there was metal. Archaeology has yet to corroborate that.
We're dealing with the translation in the text. So when it is translated as steel or as brass or as copper, whatever it's translated, even the King James translators was translating one type of steel into the terms of another that didn't exist back then.
We usually think today of steel as being a metal that's produced under using the Bessemer system, but that was not always in place, and the word steel is very old in English. Steel in Joseph Smith's day meant something quite different than it does today.
We're dealing with the translation. The point is there was some kind of metal production. As far as a full-blown metallurgy, there isn't a lot of evidence at this point in Mesoamerica. And see, this is the other point of archaeology. What we don't know today, we really could discover by tomorrow or next year or whatever. The flip side of this, the other problem with archaeology is what we do know today could very well be completely wrong tomorrow. If you're going to live by the sword of archaeology, be prepared to die by it.
A lot of people have pointed to the existence of barley in the Book of Mormon as evidence of its untruth, but in fact, pre-Columbian domesticated barley was found in the New World.
Study in 1983 found that barley in America has now been genuinely discovered in an archaeological dig, I believe, in Arizona.
Archaeologists found some remains of pre-Columbian barley, so we know it existed. We didn't know that prior to the 1970s. Joseph couldn't have learned it from that archaeological dig. Again, it was a little bit too late for him to have profited from it.
Critics of the Book of Mormon for a long time have pointed out that it's not credible because it speaks of pre-Columbian wheat and barley in the New World. But since then, there's been pre-Columbian barley discovered in Arizona, near Phoenix, from a Hohokam civilization that dates around 300 BC to around 1000 AD. And also in early woodlands cultures in Illinois and Oklahoma, pre-Columbian barley has been found.
And that also suggests that the jury ought to remain out on other grains and so on that are mentioned in the Book of Mormon. Just because you haven't found it doesn't mean that you won't find it. And just because you haven't found it doesn't mean that it didn't exist. You may never find it. Again, in the acidic soils and the heavy rainfall of Mesoamerica, a lot of things disappear. How many remains of ancient plants do you actually find from pre-Columbian times? Almost none.
Likely during the long period of wars that took place, particularly towards the end of the Book of Mormon, when it doesn't appear that they're doing a lot of farming, the wheat and barley would have had difficulty surviving. Apparently barley did, if what we have found in Arizona and Illinois and Oklahoma came from that which was brought over by Lehi and his family. But we know there were other transatlantic crossings before, in addition to Lehi's.
There is evidence of horses. Horse bones have been found in a number of archaeological digs in historical strata.
For example, there are some caves in Mexico that have Mayan artifacts in association with horse bones, notably the Lolotun caves.
They've almost always been discarded because the archaeologists assumed, on the basis of ideology or preconceived opinion, that must be site contamination. Those horse bones can't belong there. And yet they've been found at the right levels.
We're hoping that at some point these can all be located and radiocarbon tested.
Preliminary results seem to indicate that those horse bones do date, in fact, to Book of Mormon times.
There were a few others that were found to be pre-Columbian, but post-Book of Mormon. That's significant because the claim has long been made that there were no horses in the New World from about 10,000 BC until the time of the Spanish arriving here. So Columbus initially in 1492 and then followed by others. But in fact, there are a number of them that have been found in, say, the 11th century, the 13th century. They're before Columbus, but they're after Book of Mormon. So they can't be used as evidence for the Book of Mormon, but where in the heck did they come from?
So it is not a done deal to suggest that there were no horses in the Americas in Book of Mormon times. There's considerable evidence for horses. It's just been little noticed. The suggestion that tapir is referred to in the Book of Mormon by the word horse has been met with a lot of ridicule from a lot of people who, it strikes me, are actually fairly ignorant of anthropology and linguistics. It's very common for a group that moves into a new area, when they see a strange animal, to give it the name of an animal that's more familiar to them. I'll give you some examples. When the Romans first encountered elephants, they called them lucabos, Lucanian cows, because for some reason they reminded Romans of cows. Now, an elephant obviously isn't a cow. When the Greeks went into Egypt, they encountered a really strange animal that they called a hippopotamus. What does a hippopotamus mean? It means a river horse. Hippopotami are not horses, but the Greeks called them horses. And still in German, the word for a hippopotamus is a Nilpferd, a Nile horse. So you look around, you see this very, very commonly. It's so common as to be uncontroversial. Seahorses are not horses. Prairie dogs are not dogs. Groundhogs are not hogs. This happens all the time. People see an animal, it reminds them of an animal they already knew, and they give it that animal's name. When the American Indians first encountered conquistador horses, they called them deer. And the tapir itself is very similar in a lot of ways to a small pony or something like that. It's often compared to a pony. In fact, one word that was common in Mexico about 60 years ago for the tapir was the anteburro, a former burro. That had been a burro before and had now become a tapir. So you hear people ridiculing that on the grounds that they're too small and so on and so forth. They're talking about familiar tapirs they've maybe seen, but the Baird's tapir grows to be about 700 pounds. It's about the size of a donkey. And it's not at all inconceivable that somebody looking at that didn't know what it was, might call it a horse.
Their land also is full of silver and gold. Neither is there any end of their treasures. Their land is also full of horses. Neither is there any end of their chariots. Well, it's not talking about the Nephites. This is a passage from Isaiah. Yeah, it says compare Isaiah 2. And the first verse says, the word that Isaiah, the son of Amoz, saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem. He doesn't say here concerning Mexico and Guatemala.
So far, no direct evidence of chariots. There are roads in a lot of places that suggest heavy traffic. They might have been developed not just for foot travel, but for some kind of wheeled travel.
Case of Ammon and the Lamanite king. We don't know what the nature of that chariot.
It's possible, and I'm just thinking out loud here, that the word chariot may not mean exactly what we picture. Again, we always have to be open to the possibility that it's not quite what we've imagined to be a chariot. The word for chariot in Hebrew is very similar to the Arabic word for boat, and they simply mean in both cases something that's ridden. That doesn't say necessarily it looks like Ben-Hur's chariot. It might be a different kind of thing altogether. I'm not saying that's the case. I'm just saying when you're looking at ancient documents, you have to be prepared for the idea that your mental picture may be wrong, that what you imagine from the movies may not be actually correct.
Absolutely. It depends on the time period. You go back far enough and you find elephants.
The evidence for elephants is very controversial. It's been usual received opinion that elephants died out quite a few thousand years before the Book of Mormon story begins.
But as it turns out, there are some who still survived on Wrangel Island, which is off the northeastern coast of Siberia. And the latest of them is from 1700 BC, which is well within Jaredite times. Well, that doesn't prove that there were some farther south in the Americas, but we certainly should expect that they could have been.
there has been for a long time, for decades now, a minority of zoologists, archaeologists, and so on, who argued that elephants actually did exist in the Americas up until something like 2000 BC, which is just about right for the Book of Mormon, because we're talking about Jaredite elephants, not Nephite elephants.
Anything that you're looking at for elephants is only relevant to the earliest time period.
Nephites don't seem to have them. They never mention them. But the Jaredites do, not commonly, but they're there.
So that puts us a little closer to the time period when we know that there were mammoth in the area.
And so if this minority of archaeologists and archaeobiologists is correct, then the Book of Mormon has been vindicated on that point. Well, of course, the opening chapters of Genesis cover the creation of the world. That's large. But for the most part, the historical sections of the Bible cover a very small area, essentially what is today's Israel.
We've known for many years that in Arabic and in Hebrew, the name Nahom, which is the name of the place where Ishmael died and was buried in 1 Nephi chapter 16, is related to the Semitic roots, meaning to mourn, to sorrow, to suffer. But what a team of German archaeologists found, and other LDS scholars have dealt with in great detail, is that a few years ago, the name Nahom was found on three Katabanian inscriptions on altars in northeastern Yemen, exactly at the point where one would expect to find Lehi and his party turning in a near easterly direction and moving across the Arabian Peninsula. That's the place where the Book of Mormon says that Ishmael dies and was buried. We now know from this record that there was a place in these inscriptions known as Nahom in the time of Lehi in precisely that region.
It's possible that Joseph Smith lucked out in Nahom. You can never rule that out absolutely, but it seems to me the odds are vanishingly low. It has to be understood that for about 50 years, since Hugh Nibley wrote his Lehi in the Desert, there's been wide agreement among Latter-day Saint scholars on roughly where the path of Lehi went. Inland from the Red Sea, and then turning due east and arriving at a place on the Arabian Sea coast. The finding of Nahom, it's not simply a matter of finding a tricontinental route that is vintage Arabic or vintage Semitic. It's that it's in a place that is consistent with those prior theories. The theories of Lehi's route already existed. We didn't invent them suddenly to match the place Nahom that had been found. They were already there. The place Nahom was found in the location where we expected it to be found. And if you go due east from Nahom or Nahom, you arrive at really the one place on the Arabian Sea coast that fits all the requirements for Lehi's Bountiful. That, it seems to me, is a very unlikely thing to have accomplished by sheer chance.
Could it be possible that he saw it on a map somewhere?
It's possible that he could have seen it on a map. I don't rule that out. There was a map published in 1815 that indicated Nahom on the Arabian Peninsula. There's no evidence, as far as I know, of that map existing in North America by the 1820s. Some people have suggested, since there's a copy in the Dartmouth College Library, that Joseph Smith or Hiram Smith, who once went to a school connected with Dartmouth, or Solomon Spaulding even, who graduated from Dartmouth, used that map to formulate the Book of Mormon. The trouble is, according to Dartmouth College itself, they only acquired that map in late 1930 or early 1931, which is, I think, a little bit too late for Joseph Smith to have used it. I'm routinely written to by critics of the church who say there simply is no place in Arabia that can be called Bountiful. Well, it so happens that when they're writing to me on my computer at home, I'm sitting under a blown-up picture of Bountiful, what I consider to be Bountiful in Arabia. And believe me, it looks very, very nice. And a picture is worth a thousand words. The fact is the place exists, people have been there, it meets all the criteria for Bountiful. And this notion that Arabia is nothing but sand dunes and barren wastes is simply not true. You get down to the Arabian Sea coast with the monsoon rains, you actually have some very fertile areas. That's what made the civilization in Yemen possible, where the Queen of Sheba came from. It's very different from inland Arabia, where the Bedouins live. These were settled civilizations down there that depended on heavy rainfall. Alma 7:10 is often cited by critics as evidence of Joseph Smith's incompetence, that the poor guy didn't even know where Jesus was born.
This assumption that he was born at Jerusalem, and of course any schoolboy knows that he was born at Bethlehem, is precisely the problem with a non-critical reading of the Book of Mormon text, because the Book of Mormon doesn't say he was born at Jerusalem. It says he was born at the land of Jerusalem.
We don't have evidence in the Bible of a land of Jerusalem around the city of Jerusalem, but we do have it in extra-biblical literature. There are materials, for example, from about 1200 BC that refer to a place called Beit Lahmi, which is almost certainly Bethlehem, as being a city of the land of Jerusalem. Then you have materials that purport to come from the time of Jeremiah, and in that document the Jews are taken captive from the land of Jerusalem. A phrase that doesn't occur in the Bible, but does implicitly occur in the Book of Mormon. Was Bethlehem part of the land of the Bible? Well, even today, if you go to Bethlehem, you realize it's essentially a suburb.
Jerusalem, of course, back then, was the main political, cultural, historical, religious center of the Jews. Bethlehem is how far away from Jerusalem? What, 6 miles? Of course it's going to be in the land of Jerusalem.
And in the time of Lehi, it was apparently an area that was controlled by the town, the city of Jerusalem, which had a sphere of influence around it that was called, after it, the land of Jerusalem. So it isn't a mistake. It's not saying that Jesus was born in the city of Jerusalem. It's saying he was born in the land of Jerusalem, and that, we now know, fits the ancient usage.
There's no question about the scope of the geography of the Book of Mormon, because there are hundreds of statements and inferences in the book or from the book that say it had to be a limited area.
I believe it was very confined in what is called Mesoamerica, with the narrow neck of land being the Isthmus of Tehuantepec. I know that many Latter-day Saints think it took place all over North and South America, but the vast majority of Book of Mormon scholars and even some general authorities believe it took place in a very limited area.
The distances that were involved in their references suggest that it could not, their territory could not have been greater than, say, 500 or 600 miles at the outside long and a couple of hundred miles wide. All of the events referred to in the Book of Mormon took place there.
The best evidence there is the distances they have to travel. For example, you've got one instance where I think it's the greatest amount of days it took to travel was 22 days. And then there's another account where traveling from the Lamanite capital, which ironically was the city of Nephi, to the Nephite capital, which was the city of Zarahemla, took 12 days. Well, that's not a lot. That's not a great distance.
Not thousands of miles. That the book does not say, does not claim, does not hint at. So there is a geography around a narrow neck of land that accommodates all of the movements and all of the distances, but it limits it to a few hundred miles in extent.
It was obvious to early members of the church, talked about a land northward, a land southward, and a narrow neck of land. It was the most obvious conclusion in the world to assume that that meant North America, South America, and then Central America, the Isthmus of Panama. But in fact, when you look at the distances in the Book of Mormon, of which there are a great many given, a few days' journey here, a few days' journey there, you realize this area can't be more than a few hundred miles on any side. It's a very small area. Again, much like biblical Israel or Palestine. The fact is, we all believe, John Sorensen believes, John Clark believes, I believe, that we probably have found Book of Mormon cities. We just don't know, because there aren't inscriptions informing us of what their names were. We don't know the names of these cities.
I'm not aware of any of them in Book of Mormon times where scholars know the native name for that site. When the Maya began carving the glyphs into stone so that they were preserved, one of the things that they would carve into stone is called an emblem glyph. And the emblem glyph is a set of pieces of information all put together that long ago scholars recognized were was specifically connected to a certain site. It hasn't been until, I think, the last 10 years or so that they've been able to apply some phonetics to some of those emblem glyphs and retrieve some of the earlier names. The knowledge of those names, again, has to come after AD 250, because that's when they started carving them. Most are going to come after 400, AD 400. You have to be lucky enough to find one that we can interpret, and you've probably got a handful. The next issue with the handful of glyphs that we can identify is that they all come from areas that are outside of what's considered the geography for actual Book of Mormon peoples.
Now, Palenque is outside the area that that John Sorensen, for example, identifies as Nephite and Lamanite lands.
Palenque has nothing to do with the Book of Mormon. In the geography that I espouse, Palenque belongs in the east wilderness of the Lamanites. And Palenque was a nothing little, not even a town, just a kind of a village until after 400 A.D.
So that's, again, a straw man. It's not a serious point. He could have stood in St. Louis and made the same point about St. Louis. It was built much later. It has nothing to do with the Book of Mormon, and it's therefore not a Nephite city.
Before, say, 1000 A.D., we know none of them.
The last article I looked up indicated that there are, I think, 30-some-odd emblem glyphs where we knew the emblem glyph. Which means that the maximum number of names that we could know would be 30, and I don't think we know that many. Classic difference between the Old World and the New World. Absolutely true for the Old World. People have been there, they've lived there, they passed the names on. Didn't happen in the New World. New World had a lot of different conditions. There were a lot of different people coming through, conquering the area, and then on top of all of that, you get the conquest by the Spaniards. So there are a number of things that have happened in the New World, but the end result is we have very little continuity of names. Most of the names that we have for cities in the Central American area are either Spanish or they are some Spanish version of perhaps an Aztec name. Well, the Aztecs, again, are coming in somewhere around 1200 or AD 1200. They're passing their names on to things because that's what they called them based on their culture. They're handing that to the Spaniards, and the Spaniards are basing their government in Mexico City, and so they get adopt the names based on the Aztecs. So even down in Guatemala, which is pure Maya country, a lot of the names that you're going to find are based on Aztec rather than Maya languages. So there simply isn't the continuity. In a lot of cases, there isn't even continuity of peoples. Tikal is one of the more famous archaeological sites. No continuity to the modern day. This was a tremendous site, but if for instance we were to compare Tikal to something that happens in the Old World, this is Babylon, not Jerusalem. This is under the ground. This is destroyed. This is nobody's living there anymore, and it isn't the only one. The major sites of the classic Maya were abandoned long before the Spaniards showed up, and the people totally forgot what the names were. So there wasn't much of a chance to have the local memory that you do in the Old World. We can envy it, but we can't replicate it.
According to Latter-day Saint scholars who have made the most study, there are some candidates that are in conflict with each other. There are more than one candidate. Which one is the right one remains to be seen. In my own work on the geography, which I believe is the most extensive, indicates to me that there is one candidate of the River Sidon that is much more likely than any other to be the correct one, and that's the Grijalva River in southern Mexico. It could be that I'm wrong. I've been wrong before on a point or two, but the evidence is strongly in favor of that over any other candidate.
Wars are not always visible in the archaeological records. You don't find a lot of battle sites. with ancient remains of weaponry, for example. Unless you already know that there was a battle at the site and you look for it, you go out looking for it, we have to realize, first of all, that archaeologists do not just go out and dig anywhere they please. You don't go out in the middle of the jungle or the middle of the desert and say, oh, this looks like a good place, let's excavate here. Unless you know where to look, how are you going to get them?
DNA evidence points in various directions, actually. A lot of evidence does point to Asia, so there's certainly some who came from Asia. There's a recent tie that's been made by some professors over in California suggesting that Polynesians came here rather than the other way around, which is what Thor Heyerdahl had believed. But there are evidences actually for immigrations from various parts of the Old World, most of them from the Orient, but there's some also from the Mediterranean basin, including Land of Israel, Egypt, and so on. Book of Mormon does not exclude other people from those who came to the New World. And we've had a number of LDS scholars, prominent LDS scholars, as well as a number of general authorities in the early days of the 20th century, who specifically stated that we Latter-day Saints should not believe that the Nephites and the Lamanites and Jaredites and the Amalekites were the only ones who came to the American continent, but in fact that there were many who came from other places, and they even allowed that, yes, Asiatics could easily have crossed the Bering Strait, as has been believed, and could account for a lot of the population of Native Americans. For example, Sherem, we're told that Sherem, who came to speak with Jacob, had his big discussion with him. He's introduced by the words, there came a man among the people of Nephi. Came a man among the people of Nephi. Sounds like he wasn't of the people of Nephi, and yet he was clearly expert in their language. In fact, Jacob specifically states that he was expert in the language of the Nephites. Well, you wouldn't say that of a native speaker. All native speakers are expert in their language, but it would suggest that here's a man whose native tongue was not the one used by the Nephites, and yet he knew Nephite well. He had learned it, and therefore he was able to convince some people, dissuade them from their religious things. I also see idolatry as a good sign in the Book of Mormon of other people being neighbors to the Nephites. You don't just give up a belief in a God who created the earth and everything else and switch to worshiping a stone or a wooden carving or something like that. This is not an idea. I can't imagine a Christian or a Jew of today believing in the Bible and in the God of the Bible suddenly deciding that he's going to worship idols. It would have to come from somebody else. You'd have to learn that from somebody who was already worshiping these idols. And so that to me tells me that there were other people who passed that on. John Sorensen, whom you know, has written a wonderful article asking the question, when Lehi's party arrived in the land, did they find others there? It was in the Journal of Book of Mormon Studies, and I think it's a must-read. Everybody has to look at that. He discusses a lot of the evidence for other people being here even before the Nephites arrived.
People once criticized the Book of Mormon because it spoke of the building of a temple in the land of Nephi. Of course, the book of Deuteronomy says that temples shouldn't be built outside of Jerusalem, but there was a particular reason why the Deuteronomists wanted to concentrate the worship of Jehovah at one shrine in Jerusalem. We now know from archaeology that the reason they had to push so hard to concentrate all of the worship of Jehovah in one place was precisely because they were building shrines and temples outside of Jerusalem, and that was perfectly ordinary for most other Israelites.
It's true that in Judaism now, it's unthinkable that a temple would be built outside of Jerusalem. But the fact is, among ancient Jews, that was clearly not impossible to conceive. We know, for example, of the temple in Tel Arad, to the south of Israel, near Beersheba, in the Negev. And that's a temple that everyone acknowledges was a Judite temple. It was devoted to Jehovah or Yahweh. And there's no question that it was built by pious Jews. Even more striking to me is a temple that was built in the 400s in Egypt on the island of Philae in the Nile near Aswan.
A lot of Jews fled to Egypt following the destruction of Jerusalem in 586 BC. They settled in various places. In two of those places, they actually built temples. One of those was built in Leontopolis, and one of them was built in Philae, which is called Elephantine by the Greeks, Elephant City, basically. These two sites were approved by the priests in Jerusalem.
Oh, but the Elephantine papyri themselves discuss how the Jews in Egypt asked for permission from the elders in Jerusalem, and they were granted the permission to build that temple.
We have the letter from the high priest in Jerusalem authorizing the construction of the temple. So it's still preserved. So we know that temples could be and were built by devout Jews outside of Jerusalem.
So when the Nephites arrive in a new world, one of the first things they need to do in order to live the law of Moses is to have a temple. And they've been commanded to keep the law of Moses. They even went to the great lengths of getting the brass plates so that they would have the law of Moses. Well, you can't run the system of law under the law of Moses without a temple. So it's perfectly natural and appropriate that they would build a temple in their new city.
It's wrong to impose current Jewish ideas on ancient Jews. You always have to be aware that ancient people may have thought differently about these things than we do. That's a common mistake throughout this video, is to impose a modern image on an ancient text.
So these weren't apostate Jews?
No.
They weren't a different sect?
They were certainly not apostate. The case in Egypt, for example, as shown by the fact that the high priest officially granted them permission to build the temple. Lehi functions in some ways in a priestly fashion. We also know that sacrifices could be offered by a non-Aaronite priest if he was a certain distance away from Jerusalem, a certain number of days' travel. Also, of course, from a Latter-day Saint point of view, the people of Lehi would have had the Melchizedek priesthood among them, which grants them the right to officiate in all the ordinances of the Aaronic priesthood. So for us, theologically, that's not a problem.
Hebraism in the Book of Mormon is truly one of the most enjoyable, exciting evidences for at least, if nothing else, at least another cultural context that Joseph Smith himself did not possess or own.
So a Hebraism is a word that scholars use to describe a literary device or a linguistic element in the Book of Mormon that makes better sense in Biblical Hebrew than it does in English. These, of course, are very exciting for us to discover because they provide evidence that, in fact, the Book of Mormon is a translated work, that it derives from a source that has connections with the ancient Near East, the world of the Bible.
There have been a great many Hebraisms found in the Book of Mormon. I'll point to one that happens to be one of my favorites, and that's what I call the if-and conditional sentence. In English, we never say, if you don't study hard and you will fail the test. If you go out on that ledge and you're going to fall off, we say if. Sometimes we say if then. If he doesn't come by 8 o'clock, then we'll know he's not coming at all. In Biblical Hebrew, though, you often say if and. In the Book of Genesis, I did a quick survey once and I found 6 occurrences of the if and conditional sentence in the Hebrew of Genesis. It never shows up in English translations because it's bad English. In the original manuscript of the Book of Mormon, though, you get a cluster of if-and conditional sentences in Helaman, and you actually get it in the famous promise of Moroni in Moroni 10, 4, and 5. It's eventually taken out by Joseph Smith, presumably, because he reads it and thinks, this is not English. It's like no English that any English speaker has ever spoken, as far as we can tell. What it may be is, in effect, a kind of contamination from the original language into the English translation. Anybody who's translated a lot knows that that happens. You start getting into the rhythm and the sentence structure of the original language, and pretty soon your English begins to sound vaguely German, or it'll take on a Spanish hue or something like that, and you have to go through and clean it up. It just happens. It's the way it occurs. And so I think that's what you may be seeing there, is the effect of an underlying Hebrew text upon the language of the original manuscript of the Book of Mormon.
In Biblical Hebrew, relationships between two nouns are often created through what we refer to as a construct state. So two nouns are placed together where a preposition of is technically not necessary, although it's there from a literal perspective. So expressions in the Book of Mormon such as plates of brass, which would normally appear in English as brass plates, or river of water, which would, of course, in English appear as typically as simply a river or something of this sort. Some of these literary devices are reflected in the translation of the Book of Mormon. So a cognate accusative is a literary device that appears in the Hebrew Bible or the Old Testament. It's when an author uses the same word for both a verb and a direct object. Cognate means similar, and accusative refers to the direct object in a sentence. So, for example, Semitic authors will use a poetic literary phrase such as dreamed a dream. These sorts of things do appear in the Book of Mormon. There are many examples.
In the Book of Mormon, you have Lehi saying, "Behold, I've dreamed a dream," or in other words, "I have seen a vision." The dreamed a dream is a really obvious cognate accusative. The seen a vision is a little less obvious, but I suspect in the original it was, "I have seen a seeing. I've dreamed a dream, I have seen a seeing."
These are things that do appear in the Book of Mormon and suggest a connection with the Hebrew Bible.
That, I think, is what's going on there. It's a classic Arabic/Hebrew cognate accusative. It's possible that something like the cognate accusative crept in through that path. It's impossible, I think, for an if-and conditional sentence to have crept in that way because, as I've said, if-and conditional sentences are never translated in English as if-and conditional sentences. The King James translators systematically anglicized those conditional sentences, as any good translator would do, unless he gets caught up and simply over-literalizes his translation, which is, I think, what may have happened in the case of those passages in the Book of Mormon. You simply don't have a way of Joseph, who didn't read Hebrew, getting access to the patterns of Hebrew conditional sentences. There are other things that can't be explained, I think. The question of chiasmus, for example.
Chiasmus is a style where you go through a list of terms in one order and then turn around and go through the same list in the opposite order. Chiasms can be found in lots of different literatures and languages, but it tends to be used the most extensively in Hebrew, and in the Old Testament in particular, where it has been studied far more extensively than in any other body of literature. One would have to think that if the Book of Mormon is, in fact, a record of ancient Israelites, it should have chiasmus in it, and indeed it does. Of the writers in the Book of Mormon who use chiasmus the best, such as Alma and King Benjamin, we find there some of the best examples of chiasmus anywhere in world literature.
A short chiasm is the kind of thing you might pick up from reading the Bible and having an ear for style. A long chiasm, like Alma 36, or even the entire book of 1 Nephi, is the kind of thing you just don't notice casually. And in fact, scholars didn't begin writing about chiasmus in the Book of Mormon until essentially too late for Joseph Smith ever to have noticed it.
Although the repetition doesn't work for us as Westerners, there was something about it that was quite pleasing to those people in the world of the Bible. And these same sorts of forms then appear all throughout the Book of Mormon. Work a work and dream to dream and judge a righteous judgment, which of course suggests that there is a cultural, literary, and linguistic connection between the Book of Mormon and the Bible.
I think we shouldn't get hung up on the title. It simply means Egyptian that's been modified, changed in some way.
Actually, there are several Egyptian scripts. We're all aware of the hieroglyphs, which are the oldest and first texts that the Egyptians wrote in that form, mostly designed to be carved into stone. But there are two cursive versions also. There's hieratic that was used, and then demotic. Demotic is really cursive. It has lots of ligatures, and they made it so one could write it very speedily, very quickly, if one knew that writing style. And it came into use about 800 BC, so that was a couple centuries before Lehi's time.
The Book of Mormon is very clear that the writing system they use has been changed during their stay in the New World. That is, you shouldn't expect to find Old World evidence for it, not for their particular reformation of Egyptian. It's a unique writing system, unique to them, and they say, nobody else can understand our language.
Normally what the critics do is they'll go out and they'll ask scholars, Egyptologists usually, do you know anything about Reformed Egyptian script? What is that? And they'll say, well, I've never heard of it. Well, it's natural, because in Mormon chapter 9, Moroni specifically says it was called by them, by the Nephites. They called it Reformed Egyptian. That didn't mean that the Egyptians called it that.
Did Reformed Egyptian exist? Well, the Book of Mormon would be evidence that it does. Is it possible that that Egyptian has been modified in other ways, in other places? Absolutely. Coptic, for example, the language, the liturgical language of the Christian church in Egypt, is Reformed Egyptian. It's written in a modified Greek alphabet with Egyptian characters. For that matter, you could argue that some of our own letters are Reformed Egyptian in English. The letter M may just be the ears of an owl in ancient Egyptian hieroglyphics. The owl was pronounced M, and now we have this little M thing that's the ears on the top of the owl's head. So are languages modified? Yes. Anyone who's tried to read Beowulf from 1,000 years ago in English, it's English, but it's unreadable unless you've had special training. So the language of the Nephites in isolation for 1,000 years from Jerusalem, probably impacted by languages around it, referring to things that nobody in Palestine had ever seen, is going to change. It changes pronunciation, it changes vocabulary, it changes in innumerable ways. So saying that a language had changed and become a different kind of language is absolutely plausible. And I'd submit that it's even evidence for Joseph Smith's authenticity as a prophet, because he was a very unsophisticated kid. I don't know that he knew that languages change over the course of time.
Language changes in 1,000 years, and the script that goes with it is likely to change at least somewhat to go with it. So we really have no clue what Reformed Egyptian might have been.
The Egyptians and the Israelites were not always enemies. In Lehi's time, in fact, they were friends. The Bible makes this very clear, as a matter of fact.
It's probably an oversimplification to say that the Egyptians and the Hebrews were enemies. They were also, on occasion, trading partners. They were neighbors. Egyptian was one of the great languages of the period. Hebrew was not. So a person who was engaged in commerce, as Lehi seems to have been, probably would have had to learn the language of the wider world of commerce. And Egyptian was certainly one of those languages.
As it was, the Jews were very friendly with Egypt at that particular time. It may not have been at the time of the Exodus, but they certainly were in Lehi's time.
You may not like the foreign policy of the country that speaks the language, but you may be forced by economic necessity or ambition to learn the language that they speak.
Some have objected that using Egyptian to write holy script, to write texts, you know, religious texts, would be unknown and unheard of among the Israelites, because they would only write in the holy language, which was Hebrew. But actually, we do have examples of biblical texts written in Egyptian characters. The earliest of these is from the 4th century B.C., so not too terribly long after Lehi's time. It's a text written in Egyptian Demotic, but the words are not Egyptian. The words are Aramaic, but they're not using the Aramaic alphabet, which is the same as the Hebrew. Instead, they're using the Demotic way of writing, and part of that text is Psalm 20.
I'm not sure that there's ever been a time when people haven't been able to translate the languages of the Bible. Greek is still a living language. Hebrew was a living language in a sense among the Jews, even in their diaspora. They used it for liturgical purposes and for writing sacred texts and that kind of thing. And so we've always known Hebrew and Greek.
So the old world languages, as far as being able to read them and translate them, and of course having texts that we could read and translate, have been around thousands and thousands of years.
On the other hand, the languages of Mesoamerica, apart from a few indigenous peoples, essentially died out. And they have to be learned now as learned languages. And the glyphic language, the language of the inscriptions, has to be taught in graduate schools.
The New World is a very different situation. We haven't had very many texts, and dating to anywhere near Book of Mormon times, the texts are really quite rare. We only have relative handful of texts on monumental architecture from the Maya where they carved the glyphs in stone. Most of those are starting after AD 250. We have indications that they painted some of those earlier, even into 100 BC, and some of them are recent finds like the San Bartolo glyphs. Our ability to read those, probably read, accept, and really make a breakthrough since 1970. Somewhere in the early 70s, people finally dug out the work of Yuri Konorozov, who was a Russian. Did the work that actually cracked the code of the Maya glyphs, but people didn't know it for a long time, didn't want to accept it because he was a Russian. Had he been an American, we might have been much happier about it. But they finally realized he was probably right. Renewal of all kinds of interest in that happened in the early 70s. Since then, there's been an explosion, and more and more glyphs are being read every day. Interestingly enough, however, they're reading the version of the glyphs from AD 250 and later. When they find these glyphic texts from 100 BC, they're finding that although they seem familiar and they might be able to recognize a glyph or two, they can't read those yet. So moving even 300 years back in time with a similar culture, they're finding that our ability to read it has gone back to near zero and we have to start over.
The Bible has absolutely not been 100% established by archaeology. There's still a great many questions, archaeological questions, particularly about the early chapters of Genesis, for instance, but also about the Exodus, about the origins of the Israelite monarchy. We've only recently found actual inscriptional evidence of the House of David, and even that still is in some quarters controversial. And then, of course, matters like the resurrection of Christ are simply not accessible, not amenable to archaeological proof or disproof. So, no. And many of the cities and sites in the Bible are still unknown or dubious. You have great advantages in the Bible because a lot of these place names still exist today, and they're recognizably the same. Jericho, for example.
The archaeology of the Bible has found Jericho. Unfortunately, Kathleen Kenyon, Dame Kenyon, the most magnificent archaeologist of Jericho, and several studies since her time have demonstrated extensively there were no walls.
I think Living Hope Ministries is clearly using a double standard. They don't allude to any of the archaeological problems of the Bible. They overstate the archaeological problems of the Book of Mormon. They don't cite from archaeologists who say, we haven't found evidence for this, for this, for this, or for this. They don't cite archaeologists and scholars who say, there was no early Judahite monarchy. There are some who actually claim that the history of the monarchy doesn't begin till after the Babylonian exile, that all the previous biblical stories are fiction. Those are the kinds of arguments that are going out there in the real world.
The movement that's strongest in Israel now amongst their archaeologists is that the Bible is not very reliable. And that movement is gaining ground in Israel. It's tragic to see it. When I lived in Israel, every archaeologist believed the story of the Bible. Even if they didn't believe the miracles, they believed the events, they believed the places. Today that's going by the wayside, and it's kind of tragic.
If biblical archaeology is proving the Bible, my question is, what is it proving about the Bible? Are Protestants willing to accept the fullest ramifications of what archaeology is so-called proving?
But Living Hope Ministries gives its audience the false picture that the Bible's been 100% proven true. That simply is not the case. It's completely irresponsible and in a way, very disingenuous to portray it in a way that is false. People often fail to grasp the limitations of archaeology. I remember a major illustration, a major dig that was illustrated in National Geographic a number of years ago, and they had a four-page foldout showing this marvelous city of El Mirador. in the lowlands. And an archaeologist friend of mine, looking at that gorgeous painting of all the priests, their feather plumes and the huge cities and the avenues and so on, said, "Do you know how much that's really based on?" It was based on two archaeological trenches that had been dug, about 50 yards long, about 10 feet deep. And the rest was extrapolation. It was all inferences drawn from what they'd found there. He said, imagine that Salt Lake City or even Provo had been buried over for 1,000 years or 2,000 years. Then somebody digs a couple of essentially telephone booth size holes into it and reconstructs the entire social and intellectual, cultural life of the town from that. I mean, those are the limitations that archaeologists work with. They're always guessing. The guesses can be more or less informed, but they're imperfect. And most data isn't found. My overall impression is that it doesn't give an accurate portrayal of the subjects. It doesn't give both sides of the issue. It presents a Bible that's perfectly established by archaeology, which is false, and a Book of Mormon that is totally refuted by archaeology, which is also false. So it creates a simplistic and on the whole, fairly disingenuous picture.
Distinctly unimpressed with it, but the basic reason was that it had the illusion of giving you some scholarly information without actually doing it. It made things seem that they were answering certain questions or providing certain types of information when actually it wasn't as accurate as it ought to have been. So there were too many places in it where it was much more illusion than reality, that it was much less scholarship and much more showmanship.
They hold the Book of Mormon to claims that it doesn't make. They suppress LDS arguments on behalf of the Book of Mormon. It's not really you can't rely on this as an accurate picture of the situation.
Without looking or examining any of the scholarship on the Bible, they will present information about the Bible as though this is uncontroversial. And then they'll talk about the Book of Mormon, where they don't begin with that particular assumption. So the Bible starts with the assumption that's correct, and they start with the Book of Mormon with the assumption that it's incorrect. They start with the assumption that everything is correct, accurate, and true, and uncontroversial in the Bible, and assume that everything is incorrect, untrue, and completely controversial for the Book of Mormon.
There's no serious engagement in this film with any evidence on behalf of the Book of Mormon. They create a caricature, a straw man, which is easy to shoot down, easy to destroy, but it's also not true to life.
Pretty much they were discussing and arguing with what I would call popular culture ideas about the Book of Mormon that have to be at least 50 years old. They've missed scholarship within the last 50 years. Well, I certainly doubt that. I'd be shocked if they did. I would expect that they have some passing acquaintance with it, whether their acquaintance came just because they had heard something or because whoever was doing the film gave them a little bit of information. I really couldn't tell you, but it certainly wouldn't be surprising that they had a passing acquaintance. Now, would they have had a good acquaintance with the best arguments, with the way that we understand the text, the most recent information that's been done within, let's say, the last 20 years? No, I sincerely doubt that they would have known that. There were a lot of very honest people who were telling you know, for instance, all of the archaeologists from Israel, absolutely honest in what they were saying, absolutely truthful in what they're saying. It wasn't what they said, it was the implication that was made from what they said. It is very easy to take true statements and put them in such contexts that even though they are true, they seem to say something that they may not. And that's what was happening with those archaeologists. Those archaeologists know a lot about Israel. I didn't see any of them that knew a heck of a lot about the New World. When you make too many assumptions about the New World based on the Old World, you make a lot of mistakes because it's a very, very different animal when you cross the ocean.
My experience with these people is that they, for example, want to establish what Christianity means by quoting specific proof texts from the New Testament, ignoring the Old. And when they quote from the New Testament, they quote usually Paul. They'll quote things like Paul talking about being saved by grace, being saved by our faith in Christ. They don't quote Jesus even, because Jesus is the one who tells them what commandments they're supposed to obey. Actually, it's comical in a way. I mean, to me, it's comical, and it would be it would be comical, I suppose, to everybody, if it weren't for the fact that, unfortunately, these people do influence others to not look into the restored church and its scriptures. Most of the criticisms leveled against the Book of Mormon actually were already in place in the period of 1832 to 34, when some of the major anti-Mormon books came out. And for some reason, they're still being used. You know, I would be embarrassed if I were from one of these anti-Mormon ministries, but they continue to use things that have long since been disproved. But the one thing is sure, they never keep up on the scholarship about the Book of Mormon. They do not have a clue. In fact, they try to dissuade people from even reading things. They'll say, oh, don't read anything put out by Farms. Those guys aren't real scholars. When some of them find out that, oh yes, we are real scholars, we do publish in non-LDS scholarly venues, we publish with the Society of Biblical Literature, the Pontifical Biblical Institute, and other such non-LDS scholarly venues, then they say, okay, they are scholars, but only when they're not writing about the Book of Mormon.
When people tell me there's no evidence at all for the Book of Mormon, they simply haven't paid attention. There's a lot of evidence for the Book of Mormon in the Old World and the New World. John Sorensen's written extensively on this. John Clark has recently taken to lecturing on this topic, an eminent Mesoamerican archaeologist. He sees an increasing rapprochement, if you will, an increasing convergence of the Book of Mormon with the kind of evidence we're finding in Mesoamerica. Very, very interesting story that many of the things that were problematic in the Book of Mormon, certainly in 1830, even in 1930 or 1950, now seem to be better established by archaeology. When the New World Archaeological Foundation began working the Chiapas Depression, looking for pre-classic ruins, the Book of Mormon suggested that they ought to be there, according to the reading that these people were giving to it. They thought that it was referring to that area. Sure enough, there are ruins there. They date to the right periods. They seem to show certain characteristics that make them fit Book of Mormon stories. They're in the right relative location to one another. Those things all fit. So, yes, there is evidence. Now, is there proof? No. There's not proof that will compel you to believe. But proof is extremely rare in any kind of archaeology, or history for that matter. You can build up plausibilities, you can build up probabilities. You seldom come up with something that absolutely proves something. Is there evidence, though? Yeah, there's a great deal of evidence.
The Book of Mormon makes sense as plausible history. The whole thing seems right. It makes sense. There's very little in it, apart from the explicitly religious events, the miracles and the visitations and so on, that a secular historian would find it all troublesome.
Well, Dan Peterson is lying. The problem, first and foremost, with the Book of Mormon is its secular history.
First of all, I'm not a liar, and it's really a violation of sort of academic decorum to call someone a liar. You have to have awfully good evidence for that, and he doesn't. You can say so-and-so is wrong, he's mistaken. You could even, I suppose, say his interpretation is idiotic. But to call someone a liar is a really strong attack, and frankly, I did not find it very amusing. But the fact is that either Tom Murphy or his handlers misrepresented my position. The little clip that they show is from a lecture that I've given, gosh, I don't know, scores of times. And the point that I'm making is a very simple one. I'm not talking about whether the evidence is all there to prove the Book of Mormon true. I'm not talking about whether there might be things that critics might find to level against the Book of Mormon. Good grief, anyone who knows what I've written and said about the Book of Mormon over the past roughly 20 years knows that I'm fully aware of criticisms of the Book of Mormon, of archaeological and historical problems in the Book of Mormon, and so on and so forth. I've been addressing them for two decades. What I was saying in that particular point, that Tom Murphy or his handlers either misunderstood or chose to distort and misrepresent, is simply this. I was making a stylistic point. I was making a point about the way the Book of Mormon reads. It's a sober book that, apart from the miracles and the visitation of Christ and so on in it, it's a book that reads rather like a secular history. I was making the point that the book is not straining for effect. It isn't full of pseudo-Oriental romanticizing. If you read novels from the 19th century that try to set themselves in ancient Rome or in ancient Israel, Ben-Hur, for example, they're really straining to give you a sense of the exotic. The Book of Mormon doesn't strain that way. It's very matter of fact. My point was that it reads in a matter of fact way. It reads like real history. It has that style, that feel. That's an entirely different question from the one he claimed I was talking about. And I'm entirely right. He's entirely wrong. And I was not lying, and I'd be willing to discuss this with Tom Murphy or anybody else anywhere, anytime. I don't think if Tom Murphy were to apply a single standard instead of a double standard to the Bible and the Book of Mormon, that he'd be able to sustain belief in the Bible. And to be perfectly honest, I have no idea what Tom Murphy's own beliefs regarding the Bible are. It's clear that the people sponsoring the DVD are evangelicals. Thomas Murphy, though, has never actually come clean in any of those videos about what he himself thinks. When, for example, he argues about DNA, that DNA disproves the Book of Mormon or makes the Book of Mormon unlikely, he's relying on DNA studies that actually posit immigration to the New World many, many thousands of years before most evangelicals would put Adam and Eve. And he's relying on DNA studies that presume a separation of humans from chimpanzees several million years ago. This is something that I think his handlers at Living Hope Ministries probably wouldn't approve of, and yet I suspect very strongly that Tom Murphy believes in those things. This is another area where I think the film is not being entirely forthright. Let's hear what Tom Murphy actually thinks about the Bible. Let's hear what Tom Murphy thinks about the implications of DNA theories for Genesis, for example. The fact is that in religion, the evidence is never going to be clear enough. I think that's by design, to force us, to compel us to faith, to force us to obey the Lord. We're given roughly equally poised possibilities. There's good evidence in some respects, evidence is lacking in other respects. What the Lord is really trying to figure out, I think, is what do we want? What kind of people are we? Placed in a situation where we can choose either side. What do we want to do? What do we want to be? What kind of people do we want to be? And so he gives us this situation where we can listen to what our inner spirit tells us, or we can trample on it.
There are still those who, even with the vast amounts of evidence that we have for even the biblical record, still refuse to believe. Isn't it nice that we are still allowed to have our freedoms to be human, to continue learning, to either believe or disbelieve? I will grant that to them.
Ultimately, the science, the history, the archaeology are not going to force us to believe. They're not going to compel us. They're not going to give us absolutely rock-solid foundations for our faith. That's not to say that evidence is irrelevant, that you shouldn't use your mind in coming to a conclusion about what's plausible and what's not. But I think there's no Christian out there, really, who's come to a testimony of the resurrection of Christ because he or she was compelled to by archaeological evidence. That evidence doesn't exist.
Belief. Proof. The idea is, you prove it to me, you prove it to me. No, that's not how it works.
You ultimately have to say that the Jesus of the Bible, in effect, calls to me, summons to me, speaks to me, and that I believe this is true. I think the evidence doesn't rule it out. I think there's evidence for it. Enough for me to make a rational decision. To go with that. Ultimately, the decision to believe in Mormonism, as to believe in Christianity in general, comes down to spiritual impressions from God.
No, there are too many. The evidence, preponderant evidence, would argue so strongly against Joseph Smith being the author of the text. And intellectually, if you seriously study the Book of Mormon, you can come to no conclusion other than the Book of Mormon was exactly what Joseph Smith claimed it to be, a record written by ancient Hebrew prophets, translated by the gift and power of God.
I think that it strains credulity to suppose that Joseph could have done the research to put all these things together, or alternatively, that Joseph did it by sheer chance.
No. No. How? Are you kidding?
Now, there's one explanation that I really get a kick out of out there. There's a fellow that I've corresponded with from time to time who believes that an unnamed group, an uncertain number of people at an unspecified time in an unidentified place for motives that are unknown, did all the research for the Book of Mormon, and then for reasons that he can't explain, gave the manuscript to Joseph Smith and allowed him to publish it without giving them credit for reasons that he also doesn't explain. Now, if you do that, you can claim anything, because his group could have been anywhere. And there could have been 5,000 of them doing research at all times. This is the kind of theory that's unfalsifiable. It's just silly. But if you get into the real world, if you look at people like, Solomon Spaulding, who's been proposed as an author, or any of the others, they just don't have the wherewithal. I like a point that Hugh Nibley made. He said, it's not a question of who wrote the Book of Mormon in the 19th century. The question is whether anybody in the 19th century could have written the book at all. And his answer was no. And that's my answer, too.
There's different kinds of testimonies you can have. You can gain an intellectual testimony by studying the text and looking at the Hebraisms and so forth and gain that kind of a testimony, I suppose. There's a testimony, that's a testimony of the head, I suppose you could say. And there's a testimony of the hands that come from studying its principles and teachings and living them and see what effect they make in your life. And that's an important kind of testimony to have as well. But ultimately, the foundation of our testimony has to be a testimony of the heart. Not just the heads and the hands, but the heart. And by the heart, I mean the witness that comes as you study that text and invite the Spirit to direct your thoughts and feelings and receive the confirmation that it's the Word of God.
I think it's important to realize that when Latter-day Saints talk about testimonies, they're not merely talking about receiving intelligence from their own hearts. They're talking about personal revelation from God. That's a different matter. Can we trust our own hearts? Maybe not. Although in many cases we're told, follow your heart. It's not always a bad thing. But it's not a matter of trusting our hearts, it's a matter of trusting God. It's a matter of trusting what God tells us. And we're not the first people in the Christian tradition to think that in some ways God will speak to our hearts. You remember the disciples on the road to Emmaus who, after they've had the encounter with Jesus, say, did not our hearts within us burn? You know, we should have known. We knew it was Jesus because our hearts told us so.
Do you believe it is true?
I believe the Book of Mormon is true with all my heart. If you're talking about real silk, no, real silk is produced by silkworms that are feeding on mulberry trees. And that's not a New World thing. But cloth that has the same texture, the same feel, the same characteristics of silk is very tenable. Any kind of a plant fiber that's really worked and processed can get a silky kind of a texture with enough work. There are plants in Guatemala, particularly a tree that produces a cotton-like fiber that was used to produce fabric that looks very silky. The question is, why was it the word that was ever, whatever they were doing, translated as silk in the Book of Mormon? And it's likely that Lehi and his family, knowing silk, thought that they would call it silk.
Oh, I wish millions had been spent looking for evidence of the Book of Mormon. That would have been so much fun. But in fact, it's not true. It's not even remotely true. I think what they have in mind is the New World Archaeological Foundation that was established at BYU back in the 50s. The New World Archaeological Foundation was forbidden from the very start by its charter for overtly looking for Book of Mormon things, and it always involved non-Mormon archaeologists. It was never an attempt, much less a failed attempt, as I've heard claimed, find evidence for the Book of Mormon. The one thing really Book of Mormon related about it is that it chose to look in an area in Chiapas for pre-classic ruins, because that was the area and the period where the people who organized it on the LDS side thought it was most likely to find Book of Mormon related materials. But it was never given a specific charge to look for Book of Mormon stuff. It was always forbidden from doing so, and never, ever, ever published on Mormon issues. Always straightforward, very highly respected mainstream Mesoamerican archaeology. By contrast, huge amounts of money have been spent on searching for biblical sites and so on. If you scratch almost any Israeli, you'll find someone who's been out on digs. It's a passion, it's a hobby. Moshe Dayan, the great Israeli general, was a passionate archaeologist in his free time. And that's very common. And it's very easy to do. As I say, you can live in Jerusalem and go out to major archaeological digs within a half an hour or less. They're right there in the city. And so everybody does it. And because of the vast interest in the Bible all around the world and its vast importance in Western civilization, there's always been lots of money for archaeological digs there, comparatively speaking. I'm sure a lot of Palestinian archaeologists lament the lack of money. But it's nothing compared to Mesoamerica.